This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Our next guest is the Honourable Robert Redlich AM, who is the, and correct me if I'm wrong, Robert, Commissioner of the Independent Broad-Based Anti-Corruption Commission. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's Macca here. My co-host Robert is Deputy Lord Mayor Nick Rees. I wanted to, you finalised your report and you did some work with the Victorian Ombudsman as well. Can you briefly tell us, Robert, what the investigation was about and broadly what the findings were?
Certainly. So we received between us referrals both from the Attorney-General and Parliament to investigate a very specific allegation, namely that some senior people in the moderate right faction of the ALP have been engaged in branch stacking, which was the consequence of a misuse of public resources. And on the basis of those referrals, we conducted an extensive investigation. We called 26 witnesses in private examinations, those witnesses including the Premier, and we called 7 witnesses in public examinations. The key findings which we made arising from the investigations demonstrated that there had been a misuse of staff for factional work, that the work related to branch stacking, that publicly funded jobs were given to factional allies and operatives, and we also examined the grants that were made to some community organisations who were, through their operatives, providing some factional support. But it became clear from the totality of the evidence, including the review which was undertaken by the ALP through Messrs. Brax and Macklin, that the branch stacking and the misuse of public resources was not confined to one faction of the ALP, but indeed occurred across the board, and regrettably that it's been endemic. According to former Minister Scott, it's been going on for at least 50 years.
Wow. So the recommendations you've made, we'll cover those briefly in a moment. If I was to say that, you know, some people will say, oh, there's a few rotten apples in the party, or is it a case that the orchard is diseased? The whole orchard?
Yes.
It is?
Well, obviously it's important to make this significant qualification. There's always a danger in generalisations.
Yeah.
Because I don't doubt for a second that there are many members of Parliament whose motives are entirely altruistic, and that shouldn't ever be forgotten. But regrettably, a culture which is so endemic, embedded and practised for so long, must mean that for many, the moral compass became distorted. And it became an accepted thing that staff, public resources could be utilised for party political purposes or for the individual needs of the members of Parliament.
Robert, it's Nicholas Rees here. Great to have you on the program. I think you have delivered a very important report, and I'm delighted to see that the government has said they will implement all 21 recommendations, and you do detail, I think, egregious, unethical behaviour. Having put that out there, I do want to test you on something.
Sure.
Most people would say branch stacking in a political party, tell me something I don't know. But if you read Frank Hardy's novel Power Without Glory, written in 1950, set in sort of World War One, it talks about a Labour politician in cahoots with the Catholic Archbishop of the day, doing a bit of branch stacking around the Diocese of Melbourne. You know, that was set 100 years ago. What is new, and why has a line been crossed here compared to past behaviours?
Well, I think it's important that it's understood by the community at large that although the Integrity Commission's jurisdiction is enlivened only where there is a reasonable suspicion that a relevant criminal offence has been committed, once that threshold has been met, and that's got to be met at the outset if an investigation is to be undertaken, once that threshold is met, the investigation gets underway. And quite often, the end result of the investigation is not that criminal offences have been established, but almost inevitably the institutional failings which gave rise to the conduct under investigation are exposed. And what's significant here and what is new is a recognition by government and hopefully by the coalition and other major parties when they come to address our proposed recommendations that there has for so long been a lack of accountability in Parliament for unethical conduct. There's been no accountability and there's been no structure in place to monitor the behaviour of members of Parliament. And that's what's significant, that we've identified these failings. They became apparent, of course, during the Ombudsman's Red Shirt investigation. And if members of Parliament are true to the commitment that is now being made, we will see, I would think, a major transformation in the way members of Parliament go about their business.
Can I ask, Robert, obviously all the evidence that you know the Commission took, and, you know, I put my hand up here, I watched a lot of it online. It was pretty gripping. Pretty disappointing watching it, and I give credit to you and your staff for the way you ask the questions. people find it pretty difficult to answer, you know, in the way, obviously they're obliged to, but how you ask the questions. Can I ask, a transcript of your inquiry and the evidence, is that available, or is any of it redacted, or is it available?
The evidence that was given in the public hearings is the evidence, that the transcripts of the evidence of all of the private examinations of the 26 persons is not, simply because by definition the Act provides that if the person is to only give evidence in a private examination, the totality of their evidence can't be reproduced. But as the report indicates, we have extracted from that evidence that was given in private all of the significant features of each person's evidence that contributed to our ultimate conclusions.
Right.
And that's all contained in the report.
Can I ask, Robert, are you familiar with a practice called double hatting? Double hatting. So basically...
Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
You know, where a company engages a lobbying firm or an advocacy firm to put a position to government, it might be, you know, for a grant to be given.
Yes.
And what that organisation does is it provides staff to the government to run campaigns or to support members of Parliament. It was covered a little bit in the Coaldrake report in Queensland. In New South Wales and Victoria, this happens. What is your view on that? Because donations, it's not declared as a donation. The cost of those employees is actually claimed as a tax deduction by the lobbying firm. not as a political donation.
Yes.
What's your view on this? Because to me, this is exactly the same sort of thing, but it's actually worse, because an organisation is providing staff and resources to a government, to a minister or to a member of parliament, and the public have no visibility of this. And it's also claimed as a tax deduction. I mean, it's not very good, is it?
Yes. I think it's a good analogy to the current issue. Operation Sandon, which was the investigation into the Casey Council,
yep,
which is now unfortunately stalled because of litigation in the Supreme Court commenced by the principal developer, Mr. Woodman, contains, when the report is ultimately published, a very large number of recommendations spanning lobbying, donations, ministerial advisors' conduct, a vast number of planning recommendations. But in particular, we have focused on lobbying because there is, as in the area of parliamentary conduct, there is a lack of accountability and regulation in relation to lobbying.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that this report will get published soon and we can have a public discussion about the need for much better regulation of the whole lobbying industry.
Can I ask then, Robert, if hypothetically, if a firm is found to have undertaken undisclosed an unpaid double-hatting, which then would be a significant undisclosed donation, probably over the Victorian donation threshold, should they be allowed to remain on the lobbyist register, or should they be excluded?
Well, it all depend, of course, on the particular circumstances of the case, the nature of the lobbying work, the volume of the contribution that's made, the level of disclosure, if any. So I think it's difficult to generalise. Yeah. Plainly enough, the lobbying regulations which we will want to propose would enable action to be taken against lobbying, particular lobbying, which might result in lobbyists being deregistered.
Right.
Robert, your report has clearly exposed that Victoria has fallen well behind other jurisdictions in the regulation of political parties and sort of activities we've been discussing today. Which state in Australia do you think has the best model? Which state should we be looking to now to emulate in terms of our own regulatory framework?
We had a meeting of commissioners around Australia perhaps a month ago, and what emerges from that is each state and territory has similar issues, and there is no one regime which I would point to as being adequate. There are little bits and pieces from each that are worthy of adoption. I think it's probably been overstated to say Victoria is far worse than any of the others, because unfortunately, none of them have the broad and comprehensive level of accountability which is really needed for all politicians.
Can I just ask a final question, Robert? Are you surprised by what you found?
No.
No. Okay. and one final one.
If I just say this, Macca, there's a lovely article in Today's Age which focuses on the consequences for young people that are wanting to go into politics and who are faced with and learn very quickly what is expected of them if they are to follow the pathway of politics and succeed as a member of parliament. It's a really sensitive article.
It is.
And literally everything in it is worthy of consideration. because it shows, unfortunately, the danger which politics always presents, that in order to gain power or to stay in power, necessity obviously dictates what one should do rather than doing what is right.
It does. Robert Redlich, thank you for making yourself available this morning, and more particularly, thank you for the work you do as at IBAC and the folk that work with you and the Ombudsman's Office. I do hope this report shines a light on a very dark corner. You're welcome on air any time to talk about these issues or other issues. I really appreciate you making the time. I know it's not something you spend a lot of time doing, speaking to the media, so I really appreciate it and your work and this report, and I encourage people to read it, so thank you.
It's my pleasure, Macca. Thank you. Thank you, Nicholas.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you. That was the Honourable Robert Redlich, AM, the Commissioner of the Independent Broad-Based Anti-Corruption Commission, in a rare media interview. You are on Saturday Magazine Joy 94.9 with Macca and Nick Rees.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.